Malaysia charges two women suspected of killing the half-brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. It's Thursday, March 2nd. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We invite you to also check out our Facebook page at VOA Asia. Also ahead, two former ambassadors talk to us 45 years after an historic agreement with China. Cambodia media's link to Donald Trump. Indonesia's incarcerated vote. Now you can go to the moon. Stay with us. VOA Asia lifts off right now. Malaysia charged two women with murder on Wednesday in connection with the death of Kim Jong-nam, the half-brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. 25-year-old Siti Aisa from Indonesia and 28-year-old Nguyen Thi Huong from Vietnam were under heavy security as they appeared at a Kuala Lumpur court. The women were not asked to enter pleas in the case, but they have said that they are innocent and believe that they were taking part in a prank for a television show. Each faces the death penalty if convicted. They are accused of being the two women shown on security camera footage smearing something on Kim Jong-nam's face at an airport in Kuala Lumpur last month. He died 20 minutes later from what authorities said were the effects of the powerful VX nerve agent. Prosecutors want to try the two women together, and the pair is due back in court in mid-April. They wore bulletproof vests as they were escorted from the court back to prison. The case has attracted huge international interest. Attorney Selvam Shanmugam, who is representing Nguyen, told a reporter for VOA's Vietnamese service that her client stayed calm during the proceedings and was maintaining her innocence. The story continues to evolve. You can read more on Facebook at VOA Asia and also on our voanews.com website. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. EU presses Vietnam to improve human rights ahead of a trade deal. Separate suicide bombings hit Kabul. Bangladesh criticized for slow progress in blogger murders. Landlocked Afghanistan urges Pakistan to open borders. World leaders welcome Trump's measured tone and await details of America First policies. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more on Facebook at VOA Asia. And as always, visit our voanews.com website. As we continue now with VOA Asia, Tuesday marked the 45th anniversary of the Shanghai Communique. The 1972 agreement was brokered by then U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and Chinese Premier Zhou Enlai. It ended 23 years of diplomatic estrangement between the United States and China. And although the Vietnam War was still raging at the time when the communique was signed, there has been no major war in the Asia-Pacific since that time. Two former U.S. ambassadors to China spoke with VOA Mandarin reporters about the anniversary. Winston Lord talks about the One China principle.
The Chinese talk about a One China principle, which means that not only is Beijing, the PRC, the sole government of China, but that Taiwan is a province and part of China. Americans follow a One China policy, which is more ambiguous. And it says, as we have in several communiques and also in any other statements, that we acknowledge and understand the Chinese position. And we will only deal with Beijing officially and Taiwan unofficially. So that's the One China aspect. But we do not accept their principle that Taiwan is part of China. That is up to the people in Taiwan, the people in China, to work that out. It should be done peacefully, without coercion, and with the support of people on both sides of the strait. And we can live with any outcome that's freely chosen across the strait. But we're not accepting the Chinese principle of one China.
Former U.S. Ambassador to China Stapleton Roy tells VOA the agreement would likely be much different if it were to be negotiated today.
The policy hasn't changed, but the circumstances beneath the policy have changed. What I was saying about Taiwan is that we have moved from a situation where the legitimacy of the government of the Republic of China rested on its claim to be the government of all of China, because you couldn't have presidential elections in Taiwan back in the 1970s and 80s because you only had one province where you could hold the elections. And therefore, it was the ROC constitution that was created the legitimacy of the government. But now you would move to a situation where you have presidential elections in Taiwan. And the legitimacy of the government there doesn't rest on the ROC constitution, but on the fact that it's been legitimized by an electoral process. The other thing that has changed is the emergence of attitudes in Taiwan reflected in the political system, where people are saying they are no longer Chinese, they are Taiwanese. And you have a mixed picture in Taiwan with regard to that. These do not undermine the basis for our One China policy, but they mean that if we were tried to renegotiate the communiques, the circumstances would not permit us to come up with the same conclusions that we did earlier.
The communique was based on America's acknowledgement that Chinese on both sides of the Taiwan Strait agree there's one China, and that Taiwan is a part of China, and that the United States does not challenge that position. Happening now in Asia, Vietnam's foreign ministry said it firmly opposes and rejects a fishing ban issued by China's Ministry of Agriculture in waters that include the Gulf of Tonkin. The ministry said China's actions violated Vietnam's sovereignty and its territorial waters. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Cambodia's government has threatened to expel several media outlets, including the Voice of America, and is using U.S. President Donald Trump's criticisms of the press as justification. In a Facebook post Saturday, Phay Siphan, a spokesman for Cambodia's cabinet, threatened to take action against the media outlets, which he said are threatening the country's peace and stability. It appears to be the first time a foreign government has used Trump's treatment of the media as justification for its own censorship activities, something press watchdog groups have warned could happen. Trump has called press coverage he dislikes fake news, referring to it as the enemy of the people. VOA's Bill Gallo is at the White House when the news from Cambodia broke, and he joins us to explain more about this unusual but perhaps not surprising development.
This isn't a new story in some ways, right? I mean, the government in Cambodia has been in charge for, what, I don't know, 3 decades? Mm-hmm. They control large parts of the media, even though under the Constitution there is free speech. But in reality, most of the media outlets are controlled. They have threatened VOA in the past and RFA, Radio Free Asia. The thing that's different now is that they use Donald Trump and his treatment of the media as a justification for doing that. So that certainly makes it unique compared to what has happened in the past.
Governments don't have to necessarily respect freedom of speech and often don't in many parts of the world.
Right, of course. And this is sort of the first time we've seen this happen. In October, actually, the Committee to Protect Journalists warned of this explicitly. They are a political organization in a sense, as far as they make political statements, but they usually don't endorse candidates. And they didn't so much endorse Hillary Clinton as they did warn of Donald Trump. They called him an unprecedented threat to freedom of the press and to journalists, not only in America, but it specifically warned that journalists overseas and freedom of speech overseas could be endangered by Donald Trump's presidency. It warned about this in October, and this warning from the Cambodian government spokesman was the first time we've seen evidence of that. So this is happening, and from CPJ, I spoke to them yesterday, they said they expect this kind of thing to keep happening.
All right, we'll keep an eye on it. Bill Gallo certainly is. Thanks so much for stopping by, Bill.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. This was fun.
Cambodia's spokesman specifically took aim at Voice of America and Radio Free Asia, both U.S. government-funded broadcasters, as well as the local Voice of Democracy, an independent nonprofit radio station. Although Cambodia's constitution provides for a free press, most media are indirectly controlled by the state and closely monitored. The government of Prime Minister Hun Sen, who has been in power for 3 decades, has in the past criticized VOA and RFA, saying they were fomenting instability. Moni Sai, a VOA Khmer reporter, is on hand to describe more about media in Cambodia.
Actually, in Cambodia, people are comparing what's happening in the U.S. to what is the reality in Cambodia. And many people would say it's very similar. You know, some even say it's almost exactly the same, comparing both the U.S. president and Cambodia prime minister. In a sense, they are comparing Trump to the long-time prime minister in Cambodia, in a sense that the prime minister does not like the critical media. Whoever say something critical about his ruling, you know, about his party, is considered a dissident, you know, or someone who does not love the country's culture, you know, good behavior and things like that. But what is different is in Cambodia, there's very, very few media outlets that dare to be critical of the prime minister's government. It's very lucky to the prime minister, you know, in the sense that not many journalists, you know, ask tough questions, even though they have a chance to ask the prime minister a question. But if you do, you are probably lucky enough in your career, because the prime minister would not talk to the media just like the U.S. president here, even right. though, as you know, Trump criticized the media, but, you know, he talks. At least he goes to Twitter, you know, and tweet his thought out.
Fortunately, you and I get to sit down and talk about it in front of a microphone. Moni Sai from our Khmer service. Thank you.
You're welcome, Jim.
In a statement, Ching Chong, the acting director of VOA's East Asia Pacific Division, rejected the characterization of VOA as a, quote, foreign agent. He said VOA is a media organization that reports news in an objective, fair, and balanced manner, and added that millions of VOA listeners and Facebook fans in Cambodia can attest to our journalistic integrity.
The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news alert from VOA Asia. South Korea's foreign minister says the international community had to act following the alleged use of chemical weapons by North Korea in the death of Kim Jong-un's half-brother. Actions include the possible suspension of Pyongyang's United Nations seat. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. Indonesians in the country's capital of Jakarta recently went to the polls to elect a new city governor. As reporter Krithika Varagur in Jakarta tells VOA Asia's Steve Miller, it was an event that many in the country's 19-year-old democracy remain excited about, including prisoners.
The Jakarta election for governor just wrapped up. Could you give us a quick summary of what the election results were?
Right. There were three main candidates, and two of them got above the threshold of the vote that they need to carry on to the next round. But the election's not over yet, because none of them got 50% of the vote, which, according to Jakarta's electoral rules, is necessary. So what's going to happen is that two of these candidates are moving on to a runoff election in April. One of them is the incumbent governor, Basuki Cahayapurnama, known as AHA, and he came to the office when the current Indonesian president, Joko Widodo, vacated the post of governor.
And if I'm not mistaken, he's also facing blasphemy charges in Jakarta.
That's right. So he's in a unique position of being tried in a court while he's running for governor. The other candidate is Anis Badawan, who is a historically moderate cabinet minister who has come under some controversy recently for courting the hardline conservative/Islamist vote.
Now, I think one of the interesting aspects of the Jakarta election is that Indonesia expands voting privileges to many people, like prisoners, and that's something that not necessarily is done even in the United States. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about what their experience was in this election.
It's true, Indonesia does grant suffrage to prisoners who are serving sentences of fewer than 5 years. And part of that is that, you know, democracy is still fairly new in Indonesia. It's basically started in 1998, and so it's barely two decades old. And you can feel the enthusiasm for democracy when you walk around Jakarta on election day. It's like a big carnival. People are really happy to be there. It's a national holiday for the whole country, even if they don't have an election that day. And they make it very easy to vote, and people are very proud to show off their voting. And this is even the case in prisons like the one I visited, an infamous women's prison in East Jakarta called Pondok Bambu. There were 157 registered voters. And in a kind of surprising result, the person who won in their polling station was Agustio Doyono, the candidate who did not meet the threshold to continue to the runoff.
Well, that's very interesting. Now, in terms of voter turnout in Indonesia for an election like this, and how do they feel about democracy?
The turnout in the Jakarta election was really astounding, 80% of eligible voters. And they're incredibly happy and proud to vote. As one voter told me on election day, he said, "You got to understand, voting is still really fun for us. We're a new democracy. We're like kids in a candy store." And you could tell, I mean, the festive atmosphere of election day here.
Are they expecting the same kind of carnival atmosphere when the runoff election takes place in April?
Most likely, yes, just because there's a lot of excitement around this and people are very invested in it. And no one knows how it's going to pan out. And I think people are very interested in following through.
Krithika Varagor is our reporter in Jakarta, Indonesia, joining us by phone. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It was great talking to you.
Developing at this hour in Asia, Chinese parents might get paid to have children. The state-owned China Daily reports the vice minister of the National Health and Family Planning Commission says Beijing is considering birth rewards and subsidies for second children, a dramatic turnaround from more than four decades of the country's one-child policy. VOA Asia keeps you informed all day on Facebook. Now on VOA Asia, your chance to go to the moon has just improved, although albeit slightly. The private U.S.-based Space Exploration Technologies Corporation, known to many of us as SpaceX, said it's planning to launch at least two passengers on a tourist trip around the moon as early as late 2018. That's just next year. CEO Elon Musk declined to reveal the identities of the passengers or how much they have paid, except to say that the deposit was substantial, as you might think. It would represent the first privately funded journey beyond Earth's orbit with a tentative flight plan that includes a trip of up to 640,000 kilometers from Earth, past the moon and back for a parachute landing. The trajectory would be similar to that of the U.S. NASA Apollo lunar missions. Independent Australian space analyst Morris Jones tells VOA's Victor Beatty that the rocket will likely be SpaceX's Falcon Heavy rocket, which is scheduled to make a debut test flight later this year.
Falcon Heavy uses the same type of rocket stages and engines, but it basically puts three stages together, almost like a cricket wicket, to give you extra power during launch.
Is the timeline of late 2018 for this first mission rather ambitious in your view?
I think it's too ambitious, and I really don't think that they're going to meet that deadline, or if they try to meet that deadline, they'll end up compromising on safety. I think they really didn't think it out well enough.
Elon Musk, the CEO of SpaceX, said he thinks there's a market for one or two of these missions each year.
I think that there are a lot of very rich people out there in the world who would really love to fly to the moon. So I think when he talks about a market for these services, it's not a very large market, but it could be enough for, say, half a dozen flights over a decade.
Would these be similar to the NASA Apollo missions that went to the moon and back?
These are going to be far less ambitious than the Apollo mission. They won't land on the moon. They won't even go into orbit around the moon. What they will do is they will fly what's known as a free return trajectory, where you head out to the moon, you fly around the far side of the moon, and you use the moon's gravity to throw the spacecraft back to Earth. The crew of Apollo 13 did this to get back to Earth quickly in an emergency. And the whole flight will take roughly a week.
He says that there will be extensive training involved. What kind of training would passengers have to go through?
I think a lot of it will mirror some of the training that conventional astronauts go through, in the sense that they'll be thrown through weightlessness training and acceleration and maybe a bit of survival training. The main difference is that they will not need to learn how to pilot the spacecraft. The spacecraft will be piloted automatically and probably with some updates from ground control. They'll need to know how to take care of themselves and their personal needs in space, eating, going to the bathroom. But all things considered, it won't take a lot of training, I feel, to get ready for a mission like this.
That's too bad, because if you pay that much money, you'd kind of want to take the wheel for a little while. Morris Jones said he believes such trips around the moon could cost up to $50 million per passenger, although he says the cost would eventually go down, maybe to only $45 million. Elon Musk, whose company is planning to first launch manned flights to the International Space Station, has indicated that his long-term goal is to prepare for eventual human flights to Mars, and the lunar flights would represent a very good interim step. We wish everyone the best of luck as they take their trip to the moon. We're glad you took your trip to however you have listened to us today on VOA Asia. There are many ways to do it. Our friends in Myanmar do it via VOA Burmese Facebook. Thank you so much for joining us today. You can also download us as a podcast and take VOA Asia wherever you go. We invite you to do that as well. Of course, we stream on our website, voanews.com, and on our own Facebook page at VOA Asia. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Carl Starling, our managing editor Diane Gao, and for our great VOA Asia team, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Drought-related water and food shortages are posing a risk to many in Namibia, and the U.S. government is providing help. Through the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, the U.S. will purchase 8 water tanker trucks and promote community and school sanitation valued at $1.6 million. Additionally, USAID, with funding from the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, known as PEPFAR, is rolling out $2.2 million for drought assistance activities to help malnourished HIV patients, pregnant and lactating women, orphans, and vulnerable children in food-insecure districts in Namibia with a high HIV burden. In collaboration with the Ministry of Health and Social Services, USAID will support the training of health extension workers to identify and refer HIV-positive individuals and vulnerable children that are malnourished. Referred clients will receive a medical assessment and, if needed, therapeutic nutritional feeding supplements, as well as counseling on improved nutrition and hygiene. To support the Ministry of Gender Equality and Child Welfare's efforts, USAID will assist in expediting the registration of orphans and vulnerable children for social grants to mitigate the effect of drought on vulnerable children. In addition, USAID will work with the Office of the Prime Minister and UN organizations to ensure coordination, technical support, and sustainability of the response. USAID anticipates providing nutrition screening and counseling to over 42,000 people living with HIV and providing food supplements to up to 14,000 vulnerable children. These drought assistant interventions support the existing PEPFAR and Namibian government program to meet the UN AIDS targets to combat HIV in the country. Since 2005, the U.S. government, through PEPFAR, has invested over $1.1 billion in the Namibian health sector. In 2015, an additional $34 million was dedicated to accelerate treatment for all in support of the Ministry of Health and Social Services' fight against HIV/AIDS. The United States stands with its partner, Namibia, to help meet the urgent water and nutritional needs of the people of Namibia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.